My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words. In the chair, Jack Longland.
We go straight into the first round, which tests their respective vocabularies. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of the following word? We begin with Frank now. Frank, supercilious.
Supercilious. Well, if a chap wanders around looking as though he's smelling a bad smell and as though he's a bit superior to other people, you say he has that silly ass look.
but if
he wanders around looking though he's superior to everything, it's known as supercilious.
I want a slight change in external features or organs.
He raises his eyebrows.
Does he? How fascinating.
The fact is utterly right in what it means, haughtily contemptuous or terribly superior or overbearing, but it really originally meant with raised eyebrows. Cilium is an eyelid, and the bit that goes above the eyelid is called superciliosus. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, a different language. UKs. UKASE.
Is it Russian?
Yes.
It sounds very dictatorial.
It is.
It's an edict or a...
That's what I wanted.
Or an edict. Or an edict.
A Russian edict or pronunciamento, an arbitrary order, which, though it hasn't gone through the law courts, has the force of law. It went back to the time of the Tsars. I believe it's still there with the Supreme Soviet today, subject to later ratification by the Supreme Soviet, whatever that may mean. 2 marks. Dennis Norden. Sesquipedalian, S-C-S-Q-U-I-P-E-D-A-L-I-A-N, sesquipedalian.
Well, that means what it sounds like, actually. I was rather sort of ponderous, heavy-footed, long-winded way of saying... When Winston Churchill said a terminological inexactitude because he didn't want to say the word lie, he was using a sesquipedalian word, or two sesquipedalian words.
You're absolutely right, Dennis. That's good enough. Dillis Powell. Dialectic.
Dialectic, applied to materialism, by Marx.
It could quite easily be, yes, and it was.
Means, lectic, something to do with words.
Yes.
Dire across or through.
Yeah.
Arguing about. Arguments, sort of intellectual discussions.
I think that's good enough.
It's
dialectic as a noun is logic, is the art of disputation, the investigation of truth by analysis. But it comes from the original Greek, which is dialectiki techni, which is the art of dialogue, argument, disputation. 2 marks, good enough. Well, at this point, I give Dennis and Frank a quotation to think about for their stories in that last round. And Dennis Norden, yours is an infinite capacity for taking pains. And for you, Frank, hail to the blithe spirit, bird thou never wert. Well, now we do a quick flip through the pages of Palgrave's Golden Treasury of English Poetry. 2 marks again. I want to know, to what poem does the following phrase belong? But more importantly, what is its first verse or stanza? In other words, I'm going to quote a line or part of a line which comes in the middle of the poem. Frank Muir again, and this is very suitable for him. We buried him darkly.
What's so suitable about that? Do we bury him darkly, dead of night,
mm-hmm.
drumless,
mm-hmm.
and funereally noteless.
That's right. Yes, yes, you carry on that line, you'll do very well.
I think the compiler had the same sort of naughty schoolboy humour that I had, because we loved this couplet, didn't we?
Yes.
Which went, we buried him darkly by dead of night. The sods with bayonets we turn.
Absolutely right.
And the first verse is, of course, the not a drum was heard, not a funeral note. As to the ramparts, his body we harried.
His corpse. Cries of Author.
Well, it was written by one of these one-off chaps.
Yes, sir.
One of these one-off clerics, like the Reverend John Bergen, who wrote A Rose Red Sucky Half As Old As Time, and nothing else.
And nothing else, that's right.
This chap was Charles Wolfe, Reverend Charles Wolfe, well, 18th century.
2 marks, brilliantly earned. This is The Burial of Sir John Moore at Corunna by Charles Wolfe, and it starts, not a drum was heard, not a funeral note, as his corse to the rampart we hurried, not a soldier discharged his farewell shot, or the grave where our hero is buried. Well, now, Anscott James, this is a bit easier. A flask of wine, a book of verse, and thou. Nothing personal intended, eh?
Well, it is certainly from Fitzgerald's translation of Omar Khayyam.
Yes.
What's the first line, John?
I always remember a New Yorker cartoon of this. There used to be, I can't remember his name, a cartoonist in the New Yorker. He used to draw these two marvellously gross people, husband and wife sort of thing. He always had his vest on. And she would always, you know, had sort of curlers in. And do you remember them, Frank? He's drawing very thick black lines.
Oh, no.
And he's waking, and it's early morning, and she's shaking him, and she's saying, awake for morn into the bowl of night, flung the stone that sets the stars to flight.
I thought the self was terrible.
Peter Arnold, wake up, you fool, it's our honeymoon or something, or our wedding day. Well, what about it now? Let's have the
first line yet, have we?
Awake for morn into the bowl of night has flung the stone that sets the stars to flight.
That's right. Yes, that'll do. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, you know, and chill with early showers.
Oh yeah, this is a golden treasure. I say golden treasure because this also is a very mawkish poem by Thomas Hood.
Yeah,
and I remember we did that. It's about a deathbed, and there's a girl dying mm-hmm. on the deathbed. And she's not blowing very well. And I can't remember that. It's two quatrains, and the first quatrain is about her breathing. And I know it had the word breast in it, because
yeah.
That was a very big deal when you were in the first class. And then they had this thing. I remember we discussed it, because, we reckoned it was going to come up one of those questions where they'd give you the line and they'd say, discuss. We discussed it because it was an example. Thomas Hood always used to make puns, but they were generally in comic verse, and this was supposed to be sort of tragic verse, and we discussed whether puns could be set in the service of tragedy or not, because the second verse was something about when morning came
dim
and sad, and
yes,
chill
sure.
with early showers, her quiet eyelids closed, she had a different morn from ours.
Very near. Another morn.
Another morn from ours.
Oh, back first yeah. cast, Dennis.
It was a question. Yeah, I was remembering.
Thomas Hood, The Deathbed, 2 marks. Now, Dennis, the very houses seem asleep.
That's Wordsworth.
Yes.
On Westminster Bridge.
Yes. And can you remember the first lines?
Earth has not had the height to show more fair.
Yes.
Any more fair?
This is Wordsworth's sonnet composed upon Westminster Bridge, Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty and so on to the end. Now we relax a bit and have a round of international nosh.
Oh.
National dishes that have become, we think, international. For 2 marks, I want members of the team to identify and at the same time give me the main ingredients of the following dishes. Frank Muir, yours is zabaglione, or it could be zabaglione, and I don't mind which you take.
Zabaglione. Zabaglione. Or zabaglione. It's, if inaccurately made in the kitchen, is rather like drinking a glass of marine varnish, methylated spirits and custard. If properly made, it is a rather beautiful, light pudding consisting of mainly of egg yolks beaten up, maybe egg whites as well, in a warm vessel with masala wine.
That's what I wanted. Absolutely right.
The colour is yellow because masala comes from the Canary Islands.
Well, 2 marks, Frank, but you add sugar to taste. We'll give you your 2. Anne Scott-James.
Taramo salata.
Greek.
Yes.
Or Turkish.
Yes.
You'll get it in either place. Now, ingredients. Some cod roe.
Yes.
Some yogurt.
Yes.
Some garlic, pounded all in a mortar, or in modern times do it through a blender, or if you haven't got a blender you push it through a sieve and you serve it with, in the English version, with toast, but out there with a bit of rather dry old bread, and that's about the form.
Squeeze a lemon.
I'm going to give you 2.5 marks, so I'm going to come to you.
Oh,
my salata with you.
You must garnish it with sliced black olives. I'm sorry, I forgot.
True. Yes, absolutely. It couldn't be better.
You haven't got a sieve, use a tennis racket.
Oh, you coarse cook.
I doubt whether Dennis is such an expert cook as Anne is, but so his is now gnocchi. G-N-O-C-C-H-I, gnocchi.
Gnocchi.
If you like.
I noticed that because I can tell you what it consists of. It consists practically wholly of calories. And the first time I ever had it was rather puzzling because the hostess lady said, she served this sort of, I think it was chicken unpronounceable. It was chicken cacciatura, I think it's called. And she said, would you like a gnocchi? And I had the faintest idea what she was talking about. And you can't work it out from the sound either. It's a sort of dumpling. And it's semolina,
yes.
Actually.
Yeah.
Anne says that that's all you need to know. And truth is beauty, and beauty truth, and gnocchi is semolina, and that is all you need to know.
Just one final point, Dennis. Would you serve it dry or wet?
Depends on the mood.
I wouldn't serve it. The awful temptation is to throw it.
Essential information, absolutely accurate.
But serve two gnocchi unfaulted.
They're little dumplings. They can be made of flour or potato, but mainly, as Dennis Cartwright says, of semolina. They sometimes have cheese added to them, but they're served normally with a sauce. That's why I said my wet and dry. Anyway, too much. Now, Dillis Powell, couscous.
Couscous is a kind of Arabian dish.
Yes.
It's served, or possibly thrown, in North Africa.
Yes.
since I know.
Ingredients?
Yes.
Ingredients?
I don't know.
Yes, they're serving in Corsica.
Uh-huh.
Oh, well,
you rest on halfway down the hill. You remember. It's based on stuff which looks like small rice, and it's a lie. It's not rice at all. It's some kind of awful sort of flour meal.
Yes, okay.
Muck. Mm. And it's and the
what
the
with?
Other stuff, the, yes. the body of the meal,
yes.
is sort of boiled up mutton and chicken,
yes.
Dashed on top in a very heavy brown sauce.
Oh, absolutely right. This is a splendid description, Frank. My culinary dictionary tells me this is ground hard wheat with lamb or chicken steamed over broth, sometimes with vegetables added, and as Dillis quite rightly says, it comes from North Africa, from an Arabic word, couscous, meaning to pound. Apparently you pound the wheat into a paste. It
costs about a pound, yes.
Yeah, 2 marks. Now we come to the last round. And we go back to those quotations I gave Dennis and Frank at the beginning of the program. And on this occasion, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theater. And if you remember, Dennis Norden, your quotation was, an infinite capacity for taking pains.
Well, I have a theory about bits of homely folk wisdom like that one. What they spring from is pure jealousy. I mean, if you take that one, which the full line is, genius consists of an infinite capacity for taking pains, I bet that that line only made the charts throughout the years because none of us can really bear the thought that geniuses not only do things better than we can do them, they do them much more easily. You see what I mean? We just can't take the idea of achievement without effort. So it's not really true that genius consists of an infinite capacity for taking pain. And there's lots of other ways in which you can prove that genius obviously doesn't consist of just a capacity for taking infinite pains. I mean, look at very early societies. In those days, the only outstanding men were those blokes who went round experimenting with wheat and corn and barley, trying to find ways of transforming them into staple foods for the community. You see, the qualifications for genius, where they were concerned, would be an infinite capacity for baking grains. Now, those same sort of alterations in this definition could be applied today. The qualifications for genius vary according to which area of endeavor you're referring to. I mean, if you take the theater, for example, no matter how brilliant an actor is, he's never really accepted as a genius until we see him do at least 2 or 3 different versions of Hamlet. So surely that must be a case where genius consists of an infinite capacity for faking days. You see, it's all a question of where the man concerned is trying to make it. Take James Watt, for example, who's one of the greatest of our technological superstars. See, if you remember what he did, he looked at his mum's kettle boiling, he noted the steam issuing, and straight away he put every penny he had into backing the railway engine. So there's only one quality that defines his genius, an infinite capacity for staking trains. Which brings me to the only other authentic genius that I can claim personal acquaintanceship with, and that's Frank Herbert Muir. Now, Frank has many sterling qualities, which I would be the very first to deny, but not even his nearest and dearest which are those three blooming Afghan hounds, not even they would claim that he is essentially a painstaking man. No, any success that he has had can be attributed to only one capacity, a capacity which on this particular program he has laboriously helped me to go some way towards acquiring, which is a slight facility in the matter of orally telling a story into which is incorporated certain phrases that twist and distort and play upon words. So that is the only genius conspiracy into which Frank has ever recruited me, an intimate complicity for talking puns.
I'm glad Dennis didn't get further down the list than Frank Muir. We were all beginning to be a bit sort of embarrassed. He might have been next on the list. Anyway, back to Frank Muir now. And if you remember, his quotation was, "Hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert."
Sitting there in my leather chair that evening, I was quietly rereading Blake. When I'm out of thoughts and worry about the world, I often pick up Blake. My favourite is Sexton Blake and the Bloodstained and the Bloodstained Putty Knife or the Painter's Revenge. But the phone rang and there was this marvellous sexy lady's voice on the phone, this sort of girl's voice. Said, "Hello, am I talking to Frank Muir?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I want to come and interview you. Have you one piece of advice you'd like to give the younger generation?" And I said, "Yes, indeed I have. Don't trust to spirit gum substitutes when you're acting in a play with a false beard." By heavens, I learnt my lesson. It was last Christmas in the church, in the village church, we were doing this nativity play which my son Jamie had written with Nick the Vic, and they persuaded me after a lot of trouble to be Herod, so I rang through for the costume, and I rang through a good old reliable Nathan, and I said, "I want to play it rather eastern, rather sort of not just a sort of Roman Herod, but far, far more Palestinian and Arabic, a sort of Saracen Herod." And I said this over the phone, you see, and but I was a fool, utter fool, really, because you should never do anything with fancy dress over the phone. And when it came, I opened it, and there was this sort of rather reddish, long wig, and this low-cut evening dress, very low-cut. And I rang them up, and they said, I said, this isn't this at all. I said, "That's what you asked for." I said, "Saracen Herod?" I said, "You said Susan Haywood." I couldn't go on in the village hall that evening. You see, that evening was our charity preview. The Senior Citizens Club, you see, were allowed in free while we did the dress rehearsal. It was all sort of frightfully frantic, and I managed to sort of knock together an Eastern Herod's costume, and I did the beard by cutting the heel off a pair of my wife's tights, which sort of fitted the chin. And then I combed the Afghan hounds and got a lot of rather gingery hair out, and I threaded that through the nylon of the heel of the tights, and I hadn't got any spirit gum, so I used a substitute, you see, which is where my great mistake. I used that sort of creamy rubber solution stuff and stuck it on my chin. And by the time I got to my big speech, "Killed and butchered, tormented," and on the word "tortured," I had to fling sideways, and I flung sideways, and my rotted beard detached itself from my chin and sailed out and landed in Mrs. Rumbold's lap. And Mrs. Rumbold was knitting at the time. She was knitting a garment for her grandson. And as I watched, I couldn't reach her. 9 seats in she was. I saw my beard being amalgamated in her, in her knitting. And as I watched, being part of the pattern of a feral pixie hood. Well, of course, you know, the rest of the rehearsal was a travesty. The following morning, for the opening night, I cycled immediately back to Nathan's and got a proper outfit. And it was perfectly right on the opening night. I had a proper beard and I glued it on with spirit gum. And it was beautiful. And that night, after the opening night, when I was taking my 17th or 18th bow, I can't remember, the audience had gone about 10 minutes earlier. Feeling this beard, and it was tight and jutting out, firm and fierce, like a ferret's hip in a high wind. And I thought to myself, there is no substitute for spirit gum. And I stood there bowing in this empty old Saxon church. I just gave a little paean of praise to the real gum of the theatre, and I said to thee, hail to thee, blithe spirit, beard thou never rot.
And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the contest of the stories, and he and Dillis Powell also win this entire contest, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.